CPAC! CPAC! I can't hear you. CPAC! Right on. Thanks. I hear you loud and clear. Thanks, Frank, for your warm introduction. And I'd like to thank the Alliance here in Chicago for inviting me to celebrate with you your remarkable 43 years fighting against racism and political repression in Chicago. And I'd like to salute all of the honorees receiving this year's Charlene Mitchell Human Rights Award. As I look around this room, I see many of my comrades who have stayed the course, who have endured over the years, and who have remained engaged in our common struggle for human rights. It is unfortunate that as I unite with you today, it coincides with the memorial service of my dear friend and comrade, the National Alliance's lifetime member, Dr. James Tate, Jr., who passed away on September 13th in Las Vegas. And I'd like us to observe just a moment of silence for our dear friend and comrade, James Tate, a warrior in the struggle for justice, whom we will never forget. La lucha continua. Let's take a moment of silence. On a more present note, I'm told that my dear friend, Frank Chapman, is celebrating his, didn't want anyone to tell the number of years, but he's celebrating his birthday this week. I remember meeting Frank almost 40 years ago. He has certain remembrances of me. I have certain remembrances of him. As most of you know, Frank was wrongfully convicted of armed robbery and murder in 1961 and sentenced to life imprisonment plus 50 years. His case was taken up by the Alliance, and we assisted in winning his release after his wrongful imprisonment for 14 years. Since his release in 1976, Frank has dedicated his every waking moment to our struggle, for the struggle for social and economic justice in America. He worked successfully on the national and international campaigns to free the Reverend Ben Chavis and the Wilmington 10. Joanne Little, Nelson Mandela, and many other political prisoners. I can say that Frank is one of the most gifted and talented organizers that I have ever had the privilege to work with. Let us salute Frank. My friends, as we gather here to honor this year's recipients of the Charlene Mitchell Human Rights Award, we cannot have a meaningful discussion of human rights in these United States without reflecting on what I call the badges and indicia of slavery and racism under the color of law. It is what I describe in my book, The Illusions of Justice, Human Rights Violations in the United States. This book was an adaptation of the petition that Frank talked about that was presented on behalf of the Alliance, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Commission for Racial Justice, the United Church of Christ. Last week, I was watching our President Barack Obama addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations. And I was reminded of America's dismal record and its history, dismal human rights history at the United Nations. Whatever America had advocated as being the assurance of human rights for all mankind in its Declaration of Independence in 1776 and in the Bill of Rights of 1796, is certainly not evident if you look at the United States voting record over the first 33 years of the establishment of the United Nations. Just give you a short example. There was a resolution 637 of 1952 calling for countries to recognize the right of self-determination as a prerequisite among all peoples. The United States voted no. There was a resolution calling for all means possible to be used to ensure that self-determination of all peoples be granted. United States voted no. The resolution calling for native people, that these native peoples should be used in the governments of their territories. The United States voted no. There was a draft resolution in 1960 which called for the elimination of colonialism, that this act to eliminate colonialism will be entirely be beneficial to enter into negotiations with representatives of colonial territories. The United States voted no. Resolution calling for the affirmance of the realization of the rights of all peoples to self-determination and for speedily granting independence to colonial countries, the United States voted no. There's a resolution condemning mercenaries that were used to repress peoples fighting to fight colonialism. The United States voted no. Resolution calling for the inalienable rights of indigenous people of Southern Africa, recognizing that the national liberation movements were rightful. United States voted no. A resolution calling apartheid a crime against humanity. 97 countries voted yes. The United States voted no. Now, the United States boasts about leading the fight in defeating the Nazis in 1945 and played a leading role at the ensuing Nuremberg trials in 1946. The United States also boasts about liberating prisoners, the concentration camps of Auschwitz and Dachau in Poland. Now, you would think that given that the United States claims that it played such leading roles in fighting against Nazism and liberating prisoners from those concentration camps, that when the Genocide Convention was enacted in 1948, that the United States would have done what? Would have supported it. Although the convention was signed by then President Harry Truman in 1948, the US Senate refused to ratify it. Now, before an international treaty could become law in the United States, it must be ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate. The Senate refused to ratify, and it took 40 years. 40 years before the United States ratified the Genocide Convention. It went into effect in 1948. It was ratified in 1988. Why didn't the United States sign such a fundamental document? They were afraid. The Southern senators were afraid that if they signed such a declaration, that African Americans and Native Americans would bring a case at the United Nations against the United States for what? Genocide. They knew what they had done and were trying not to enact the convention. In fact, William Patterson and Paul Robeson in the early 50s did bring a petition at the United Nations charging the United States with genocide against black people. If you read the congressional record of all of the debates that took place during that 40-year period, you will begin to learn why the United States refused to sign and ratify the convention. The United States also took 27 years before it ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It took 29 years before it ratified the convention to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination. And although the United States finally ratified those human rights documents, it did so with a number of reservations. And among those reservations was an agreement that the documents would not be self-executing. But the United States unwittingly provided us as activists in the community with an opening that we can exploit to force the US to be accountable before the United Nations and the world community for human rights violations committing here. And I will talk to you about that later on. It is with this background, my friends, that I would like to briefly review what I contend is a history and background of the consistent pattern of gross and reliably attested violations of human rights committed by our government, United States government, against blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, and all people of color. If one examines the effects and results of the criminal justice system within these United States, it becomes clear that blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, and other minorities are victims of a deliberate governmental practice and policies that deny them basic human rights and abridge their fundamental freedoms solely on the basis of their race, solely on the basis of color, solely on the basis of national descent and ethnic origin. These racist policies and practices are sharply manifested by what we see being played out on our TV screens on a daily basis today throughout the United States. And that is the human rights violations that I characterize as police crimes. My friends, the police crimes being committed against people of color are the most egregious human rights violations being committed on a daily basis in the United States. The irony is that this phenomenon is not new, but it is chronic, it is endemic, and it is persistent. The Kerner Commission, almost 50 years ago, cited it as one of the major causes of the rebellions that were in our cities in the 1960s. The hypocrisy of the United States is evident in its foreign policy decisions, in taking upon itself the duty of being the policeman around the world, responsible for denouncing and monitoring human rights violations around the world, while consistently refusing to acknowledge the validity of serious and blatant human rights violations within our own borders. Barack Obama, for the first 7.5 years, has been trapped in a trick bag. Although he knew of the endemic racism that permeates the criminal justice system, he dared not explicitly say so. It is only within the last few months that he has found his voice. You hear politicians proclaim proudly that we are a country of laws. But my friends, the law has never been a friend of black people in America. American society functions normally through an elaborate framework of laws. But poverty, racism, injustice, and oppression of peoples at home and abroad are not acts falling outside the law, but they are inextricably entwined in its operation. Indeed, they result from the system of law. It was the law that transforms people who look like me in this room into capital goods through the system of chattel slavery. And it was the law that denied them their humanity. And it was the law which divested the Native American tribes of their lands, divested them of their culture and their future. Every 4th of July, we hear school children recite the preamble to the United States Constitution without knowing or understanding the context. When the founding fathers of this country, all of them slaveholders, George E. Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and others, then they announced to the world, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creators with certain inalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As they were proclaiming those words, these hypocrites were looking straight into the faces of 700 African slaves, one-fifth of the nation they proclaimed to be free. While they were uttering these words, they were standing on land stolen from the Native American tribes. The very Constitution of the United States rejected the humanity of black people by counting them as only three-fifths of a person for determining the number of elected representatives that slaveholders could vote in the first National Congress. Now, why is this history important? It is important, my friends and comrades, because the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution, and if you read the rhetoric of this amendment, presumably abolished slavery, but it did not abolish the badges and indicia of slavery, which we are struggling with today, and which is reflected in police crimes against our community. Comrades and friends, echoing the immortal question posed by a philosopher named Lenin, what is to be done in this period? The fundamental remedy, I believe, to addressing police crimes in America is accountability. The police must be accountable to the communities they serve, but here lies the contradiction. Which community do the police serve? My friends, we have to understand the dialectics and we have to look at contradictions. The system of economic exploitation in the United States relegates minorities to the bottom of the economic barrel, and the police are there, empowered to keep the lids on their neck. That's the role of the police. Thus, increased unemployment brings with it increased community struggles, confrontations, and the inequities of the existing economic order, and increased community struggles. And as the community struggles, they are met with increased repression by the police. Today, the police and law enforcement protects the economic interests of corporate America. Not the mayor. He is only a tool. Their primary function is to maintain the established economic order. The police are ultimately, in the present structure, accountable to corporate economic interests. When and only if corporate America's economic interests are jeopardized by the lawlessness of the police, will they agree to make them accountable to the communities in which they work, for example, CPAC. Therefore, in our struggle for community control of the police, we must force corporate America to choose between maintaining and supporting the existing structure of lawlessness of the police, or face economic losses, or agree to community control of the police. We should develop a multifaceted approach which includes highlighting the abuses by taking to the streets with public demonstrations. Also, We should bring civil suits against the cities, the police departments, and individual police officers for money damages and injunctive relief. However, my friends, we have to be aware of the limits of the law, and I talk to you as a lawyer. But I'm a radical lawyer. If you look at my FBI files, and I know I definitely will have another page added to it after my speech tonight. But when that page is looked at, it will be redacted, because the agent who reported on what Hines said tonight will be redacted. So we have to know where the law stops and power begins. Power begins with you, and you, and you, and you. And we have to take power. We have to begin selectively targeting specific businesses within our cities for boycotts. We have to hurt them economically. They will surrender the police based upon profits, because that's what they're about. If they have a choice of putting the police under our control or suffering economic loss, there's no contest at all. I'm not saying this is the only approach. It should be multifaceted. But we have to look at the contradictions that we have, and we have to exploit those contradictions to the detriment of our foes. Now, earlier in my remarks, I shared with you my observation that by signing certain protocols, the United States government had unwittingly provided us with a mechanism to bring and highlight human rights violations committed by the United States government to the United Nations. You see, the United States signed the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. But they also signed some protocols which required them on an annual basis to give a report before the United Nations on progress they have made with human rights and adopting the provisions of human rights in the United States. It then provides us with an opportunity to do our own investigations, to conduct our own hearings. And while we are taking to the streets here in the United States, while we are filing lawsuits, we ought to force the United States before the world community to expose their dirty linen, the human rights violations that are being committed. And that is what I am proposing that we do, and we use those contradictions. I'd like to thank you for providing me with this opportunity to share some of my observations and thoughts. Lawyers, like preachers, have the reputation of trespassing upon your patience and time. And I know that the ear can absorb only as much as what you're sitting on can bear. So thank you very much. CPAC! 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 Right on.